So we want to conclude some of the discussion that we were having on ways of resolving conflict within our own consciousness, conflict within our families, conflict in our communities. As we see, this is Kali Yuga, a time of extensive protracted conflicts. And so we are taking notice that success in practically any operation has to do with healthy resolution of conflict. And where someone is having trouble with his or her own spiritual life, it has to do with conflict going with the mind, the senses, and a weak intelligence. And where there is conflict in relationships, we see so much failure, separation, divorce, even violence sometimes. Conflict in the communities bring environments where people are not feeling quite wholesome, where people are doubting about their future, where individuals are not creating synergy, but adversity is sometimes more prominent. When there's conflict, it minimizes unity with diversity. Now, a couple of things we want to do before we sort of go over our summary is we'd like you to think about, and just share for maybe 5 minutes or so, a particular instance where you unequivocally thought that you were right in some particular concern, to later find out that you were to that degree wrong. That an instance where you distinctly felt that you were right. The way that you were evaluating things, perceiving, codifying, that everything was aligning itself in such a way that you were just totally convinced that you were right. And perhaps even trying to convince others of your point of view, your righteousness, to later find out that you know that you weren't. Can someone, one or two of you, share instances where you may have encountered that, where you were really considering that you were right? Of course, we know that you were right most of the time, and so it's hard to think about a time that you were feeling so strong and realized that you weren't right. But maybe there's a few instances where you weren't having quite the perception of clarity that you in fact thought that you had. Can someone share such a situation with us? You can think of a case where they've had that sort of encounter where you really, I mean, strongly felt that your position was correct, that you were right. And very much you were holding strong to that feeling, to later find out that you weren't accurate. Can someone share? You can start. Where's James? He's not around. Okay. Just summarize for us. Okay. She has. And a child shall lead us.
In a mass problem, like my teacher kept saying that, like, I was wrong, and I was seeing too that I was right, and in the end it turned out that I was wrong.
So what we can, before I comment, anyone else? Thank you, that's a nice situation. The teacher was helping her to see that she was not proper, not right. She really thought that she was. And later, through some processing, she saw that she was wrong. And of course, in this case, she was also able to admit sometimes we can find that we're wrong. We still do not allow ourselves to accept or to admit our mistake or our fault. Someone else can share the situation? Please, enter.
Having been a Christian, when I was a distant, I felt God did not perform. And when I was healing,
sure and certain that God had a form and that that was Krishna. That was the deepest mistake that I lived through. That. So I'm very wrong to my Christian fellow friends, and so wrong that they treat me sometimes like an enemy. And that hurts very deeply. But it doesn't matter.
So, in so many ways, before we embrace Krishna consciousness or began more intensely on our spiritual journey, we had many conceptions about so many things. And due to association, due to reading, due to other things, we have come to other conclusions. In our case, it's a math issue. So, ego was strong, and so the ego was causing her to see only in a certain way, and ego was causing her to see things in a particular way. It's not hard for someone to be locked into a particular perspective or mindset, especially if we're not valuing the other person's opinion we see sufficiently, or if we're not ready to incorporate other variables into our mindset. And we know that there's so many people who are very narrow-minded about particular things. And some, when they have exposure, they are ready to process and to reflect. But there's some people who refuse to allow anything to enter outside of what they are holding on to. Now this is one of another areas why sometimes conflicts are difficult to resolve. Because it's hard if we are only ready to see according to our particular perspective. We're discussing that in spiritual circles, it's always important to try to be the servant of the elder or the caretaker. It's important not only to be right, but to be helpful. It's important not only to distinguish what is right or wrong, but it's important to be right in the right way. It's important to be right in the way that you communicate, that you assist someone else, you empower someone else, you educate someone else. In material senses, often things are polarized, that it's just a matter of a combative kind of posture, and somebody is eager to be right to show that the other person is wrong or to smash them, etc. But in trying to take healthy advantage of conflict, we want to see how we can use the differences to be able to create something better. Now what I want to do, I want this side of the room here to give some arguments why the only thing that is necessary is to chant Hare Krishna. That all one has to do perfection of their life is to chant Hare Krishna. Okay? That's this side of the room. And I want this side of the room here, it's like it's kind of a man versus a woman thing. And we'd like this side of the room to present some arguments that is not about this chanting, but it's about service. Okay? So you get some concerns in your own way why service is most important. And on this side of the room, you share some reflections and why you feel that really all that's necessary is for one to deeply chant the holy names of the Lord. And that's it. Okay? So this side, all that's necessary is to chant. And on this side, we're looking at all that is really necessary is to serve. Okay? Okay, who'd like to start off first? These are the chanters only. This is all that's necessary. And on this side, all necessary is service.
Okay.
Next time I have to have two microphones here.
In Kali Yuga, there's no other way, no other way, no other way. Depend on what people want to do. I do anything else for me.
Okay, so he has offered from Shastra, although he's only taking part, he's taking something out of context in one sense, but he's saying the only thing that's necessary is to chant. That's all. Okay? Let's have some more arguments. All that's necessary is to chant on this side. And on this side, all that's necessary is seva, is service. Okay, that's, so we heard one. He's giving us the proposition that all we need to do is to chant. That's it. Okay. Someone else? Well, the mic is on this side. Some chanters? Okay.
The Sri Ramamrita is full of quotes on the benefits of chanting Hare Krishna.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, can you share one with us? Anything that comes to your mind? Okay, you'll get the whole book. Okay. All right, we'll keep that as some evidence. That in this Sri Ramamrita, he said the evidence is the book itself, huh? Okay. This is, secondary evidence, but we'll put it in the file on this category over here. Some more primary or secondary evidence? All you have to do is chant?
Well, when chanting, we're actually asking for service, so unless we chant, we can actually serve, so chanting is more primary evidence.
No, all we is... We're asking on this side only to give arguments on chanting. Okay, you just defeated yourself. Okay. Only on chanting, and this side only on service. You have an argument only on chanting? Why he's thinking, anyone over here? Only for service? Okay. Let's pass it to the mothers, okay? You have one on chanting only? Let's get one more on only on chanting. All you have to do, perfection of your life, is you just chant Hare Krishna. That's all. Isn't it? For what you can share?
How about Krishna consciousness is still away from Krishna, it's always associated with Krishna. And that's the whole goal of life. That's the whole goal of becoming Krishna conscious. And when you're chanting the holy name, you're achieving that goal. This is one reason why Lord Chaitanya gave this process is the most important for this age. This chanting Hare Krishna, because by chanting Hare Krishna, you immediately elevate to the spiritual platform.
Okay, so he's letting us know that within chanting the Lord's name, everything is there. It immediately elevates you to the spiritual platform.
Okay.
Okay. We'll take one more on this side.
And Guru Maharshi Prabhupada said that the most important instruction of the spiritual master is to chant 16 rounds.
Mm-hmm.
The most important is the first instruction of the spiritual master. And also, we have so many examples of previous acharyas. Just like Haridas Thakur, who made chanting the foremost activity in his life.
Mm-hmm. Okay, give an example of Haridas, who primarily was just chanting all day long. You see amazing effects. Okay, let's pass it to some of the mothers this side. Some discussions why service is all that's needed.
You've got Nama and Name, so Krishna is known on different, but just as you mentioned the spiritual master, one to get the name. In order to get the spiritual master, one has to make any devotion service later. And then he'll get the name of the spiritual master, and then he'll get the holy name. And also if you want to understand the holy name, which is non different from Lord Krishna, you have to Krishna and also understand or approach Krishna. As he said many times in the Bhagavad Gita, you have to can only approach him through devotional service by Bhakti Mam Abhinanati or Pacham Pushman Mam Trayam, where you just offer him with love and devotion only flowers or water.
Okay. Okay. She's saying before you can get Nam, you have to do service. Unless you do service and you have guru, you don't get any of these things. Then Krishna said, well, what you can offer him. All right. There's someone else? Anyone?
So each soul is an individual, and in order to show the individual that they all have different desires and ways of actually performing the service, and I guess we couldn't really show our individuality if we were just chanting Hare Krishna and following him.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We are individuals, and we have individual ultimate connections with Krishna through service.
I'd just like to say that serving in the service energy, service can make you humble, and one should chant the holy name of the Lord in a humble state of mind. And serving the pure server will then that helps keep you humble.
Okay. So wonderful. So through this service, become humble. And without service, you can chant. It's going to be like a parrot, huh? Okay. One last one. Anyone else? Okay. Listen.
If we look at serving man as service to God, mm-hmm. then we can assure that the energy that we serve, that we serve with selflessness and humility and purity, and that by doing that, it's like the other one was saying that if we picture ourselves as an individual, that you know the individual self is the ego, and that there is no greater way than offering of yourself with humility and purity, offering all the works that you do, make everything that you do as an offering to God, and seeing what you do in service to man, serving God, that it helps with the eradication of the ego.
Okay, wonderful. Okay, so you see what just happened? Is that we have this side of the room to present basically that only is important is chanting. This side of the room that mainly is important is service. And of course there are powerful arguments on both sides. And this is what often happens when we're dealing with conflicts. Is that people can have a very interesting view, and many times it can be very accurate to a certain extent. But sometimes people are having their orientations and their perceptions, and even though they have something wonderful to offer in a particular flavor, but it doesn't connect, or they're only able to see what they're offering. And that's it. Now, if we take what has been said on both sides and if we put it together, then what we really have is something extremely powerful. Because we have a deep understanding about the importance of chanting, and we have a deep understanding about the importance of service, and we have a deep understanding of how they both really complement each other. Because by more and more quality chanting, we're calling to serve and to be proper servitors. And by more and more quality service, we are listening ourselves to be able to go deeper in the name. And so what we really have is what's called a synergy. Synergy is when you take 1 plus 1 equals 2 and more. When we have adversity, we have 1 plus 1 equals less than 1. So understand that. When we have adversity, then we have different polarities and they attack and they take away from each other. And at the end, you have less. When you have two people fighting, they both wind up losing because there's some anxiety, some waste of time, some wounded persons, etc. So, synergy means that when we bring two things together, we come out now more than what we would have had alone, or more than what we would have had just by putting 1 plus 1 together. it will always be more than two. So we take the arguments on the name is the only thing, take the arguments the service is the only thing, we put them actually together and we see in a deeper perspective why chanting and why the service are actually so important. Now, one of the other things, and then go to our charge. I'd like to have a husband and wife couple to come up to volunteer. This is better for her husband not there. Who's out there in the yard? Let's see. Come for. Is it your wife here?
My wife.
Go. Oh, they have none here? What's that again? Who's here with their wife? We're calling Aditya? Okay. Here you go. Aditya? Who's better than our president? We need to look.
For a second. I thought I'd be late.
Now, here is a lovely couple with a wonderful service and our caretakers here. So, we're discussing that every relationship has some issues, some crises, some conflicts from time to time. We'll put in a little more into the points that we've been sharing. But one issue that's very important is to find more ways how to increase our communication, but most important, to increase our ability to be able to understand the other partner, increase our ability to be able to, increase energy. How we use those differences to come to something higher. But a lot of it starts out with open and healthy communication. So, what I'm going to ask you guys is one short question. Is on a scale from 1 to 10, how would you relate, how would you rate your relationship? In other words, let me explain the book first of all. One is that it's really on the rocks. 10 is that it cannot be better. Okay? So, but I don't want you to know how the other person is going to rate it. Alright? So,
I'd like to. In terms of communication?
Yes, this is overall. I'm talking about everything. It's easy to think about, but if you had to put a number on the relationship from 1 to 10. 1 means that you already made a mistake. And 10 means that it's a relationship made and right on the hook. Made in heaven. So 10 is the best, 1 is the worst. So first, I want you, without even looking at it, right on the side. Okay, so let's see. I want you to write a number that you think the relationship is. All right, you see why I'm going to.
Okay.
And turn the
page?
Yeah, turn the page. Now I can do the same thing. So you write what you feel that relationship is from 1 to 10. Okay. Alright. Okay. So, Ajita feels that the relationship is a 6. Okay? Alright. And his wonderful wife, so the relationship is an 8. Alright? So, here we have an 8, and we have a 6. So this automatically lets us know that there is some little lack of communication. They're not 2 6s. Not 2 8s. So, first we'd like to ask the mother. So you are seeing the relationship as an agent. What do you feel is needed to make this relationship a 10? I want you to share with Aditha, and we all can hear also, what you feel would make this relationship a 10.
Let me off now.
Okay. It's almost a 10. I mean, she's quite satisfied in the relationship. But what would make it even more dynamic for you, having a spiritual husband, child, relationship, what do you feel would assist in making this a 10? This means that the relationship is pretty strong, she's pretty happy, but obviously we're saying the Kali Yuga, death world, and life itself is about duality and eternity. But the more that we can control, master, and use the issues for growth, the stronger the association relationship is. So if you can share with us, what things you think is two things you can share with us perhaps that you feel will help to make this relationship actually change. It's wonderful now, if you want to share with us, what can be even more wonderful in this year?
I'll give you my. What do you think? What comes to you that you feel could actually make this relationship a 10? You forgive us, we put you on the spot here. Okay. Here's a wonderful time to have a powerful heart-to-heart connection here. What do you feel would make this relationship even more wonderful? That you would feel this a 10? Okay?
Well, I think everything's pretty good.
Yeah, but you didn't say a 10, you said 8.
Because nothing can ever be 100%.
Exactly. That's right, I mean, nothing can be 100% in the material world. But still, there's something that you feel that could probably make it stronger. What comes to your mind that you feel that could make this relationship stronger? He wants to join them. He said, I'm the one who'll make it stronger. He said, I'll make it stronger. Huh? I'll tell them. I'll let them know. You'll let them know, huh?
Okay.
What's your answer? Your answer? Okay. Is this something that you think would make it a 10? You're going to tell us. We'll decode that.
What do people usually say?
Huh? What do you think? What do you think would
make it? What do
people usually say? It's up to you. You just say what whatever you think.
You just
be honest.
Yeah.
We've been all having, you know, a revealing discussions here. What do you feel? Make it a 10. Just think of something that you feel would actually make the relationship even more wonderful. It's already wonderful.
Yeah.
What you feel would make it even more wonderful. What thing do you think? Huh? he wants to tell. Is he going to tell? What do you think? What do you think? Don't be bashful. What do you think?
I'm thinking my mind is blank. I get really nervous in situations. Like,
okay.
I'm trying to make something up.
You got a block.
Like,
huh? Well, why are you thinking? Well,
what's that? I'll ask
you. Okay. We're still going to ask you again, though.
Yes.
Okay, so, Aditha and the patient is a 6. All right? So, there's some things that he feels would help to make his relationship a 10.
10.
Already, there's a sign from what she says. We hope she can be really what she really means. She says the relationship is a lot more wonderful than what you're feeling in general. You said 6. You said 8. Or maybe she's afraid to speak. Let's assume that she really means it's 8 and you really mean it's 6. So what do you feel
that it's wonderful now, but what do you feel would make it even come to level 10?
Well, I think I'm selfish, doing my things. I would probably accommodate my partner a bit more. Sometimes I'm aware of things, but I'm with my things. But I cut that off, that makes me a six instead of an eight.
So he's saying that he feels a relationship could actually be a 10 if he himself would make some adjustments. It's interesting to hear, because that on her, he's saying that he feels that he has to be a little more attentive, and perhaps less selfish. The nature of his service, of course, wanting by trying to save the world and minimize taking care of the family and to have a balanced arrangement. So he's looking at the relationship and saying, if he's a 9 or 6, there's an area that he feels personally that he should be able to give a little more attention to that would make it stronger. And the main thing is to take this category of selfishness, doing what he feels he has to do, and sometimes not considering what the need for the situation is of the wife or the family. Okay, now, you can share yours with us. Otherwise, I'm going to keep it here for 1 hour. You can take a seat. You see it? What do you think? It can be either way. Okay. What you feel that you can do, or what you feel that he should do. But somehow you said it's 8 rather than 10.
Yeah.
So what things you think could be done by both of you or one of you that can make it 10?
Okay. Well, I agree with what he said also, but on my side as well, because you know I can see what he's saying also, but I can also see that I can support him more by not.
Are these guys telling the truth?
Yeah.
What do you think about this? What you listen to them, okay? You tell me, they tell the truth? So, if I hear you right, what you're saying, same thing he's saying.
Yeah.
Okay. So, what we saw right here, just real brief, is that it's very important. Very important for the parties to be sensitive to what the other person's needs and concerns are. So many times we know what we are not doing. Somehow we don't get around to doing what we should be able to do. Or sometimes we are so much into what we are doing, we don't have a chance to see what the other person's needs or concerns are. Now here, you know, a little nervous. And so she said the same thing that he's saying. Maybe that's fully with me, maybe not. But sometimes we'll find that one person feels that some particular things is needed, the other person will do particular things. But somehow there's a lack of communication about those issues. They can go on for years and years and years and not, in fact, need to be addressed. So what we did find is that Anita is identifying that he feels that the relationship would definitely be stronger if there's more attention given to their family situation. So that conflict does not prevail or come up, arise, or become accelerated, then it's important the things that we are sensitive to in that nature that we try to get a little more time to. Okay, this is something else. You can have a seat now. Next time I come on, that's a little one. What's my mom? Yes. One of the couples here? Now, after dinner, I want two of the volunteers.
This is the white flag.
I'm going to cook one for the next month. Now, after dinner, let you think about it, I'm needing two of the volunteers. I need a volunteer of two people who are here who are having some issue of conflict that's going on in their lives, okay? There's two of you who are willing to call that down, who are having some issue powers in a relationship. It may be two women, it may be two men, or it could be another couple, but I want a couple, two people, who are having some crisis in a relationship. Okay? Think about that.
That's the same thing? What you know?
He's not supposed to see it. So the one is ten.
Ten means wonderful.
So eternal husband for many lifetimes. The best thing that happens to you. Everything is perfect in the relationship. Okay, now you're right.
What she is?
What number?
What the two of you are. Yes. What you feel, the combination of the two of you, what number you feel that the relationship this is. I mean, when you bring two of those bottles, she brings two, if you both bring together, what number you feel it is. Okay? Alright? So, fantastic. Okay? Husband's dad is a nine. And let's see. The wife, you guys are really good minds, huh? And she says it's a nine. But you all what we see here is two things. First we see is how much they are on the same wavelength, you know? And we also see, from the papers, a high level of satisfaction, you know, a good concerning relationship. That is almost a 10. So we want to ask both of you also, what do you feel is needed in the relationship to make it a 10? Okay, there you go first.
Good more good.
Good more good?
Getting on my case.
She's not giving the case too much, it's nine. So, what should you feel would make it better as well?
I think as she becomes more Krishna conscious, she'll be more satisfied.
That's my answer. That's not true, it's actually the other
one. Okay, so
that's true. Tolerate me more.
His answer is that if he's more Krishna conscious, and if you're more tolerant.
If she is more Krishna conscious, then she can tolerate me more.
Okay, she's more Krishna conscious, we'll make it soon. Alright? And is that what do you think?
Yeah, I really feel strongly that I don't have like a spiritual master like a lot of people do, and I've always looked up to Bhagavan, but you know, at one point he's let me down on a spiritual level, like he doesn't know as much as I do. No, that's not true.
Well, not the microphone.
Can
you say it again?
Okay.
No, I would just like Big Run just to be a little bit stronger. Like, I feel he doesn't know the scripture enough that I need to hear it, I need to get it from him. But that's okay because that helps me with somewhere else.
Okay. So what we have is that the relationship is quite strong. It's a nine on both sides. And so there's a lot they're sharing, their mentality, they both see it as similar. Bhagavan is mentioning about being more spiritual. He's thinking that she should be more tolerant. And he's saying that she would be so much happier in the relationship to the point it would be a 10 if in fact that he would take more of the role of being more the spiritual guide, spiritual master, husband as the first spiritual master, etc. Now, you see, the beauty of this is that already they are quite satisfied and they are communicating, aware of what they feel would actually make it better. Now, how powerful if they take advantage of what the other person's cry or need is to be able to act upon that so that the relationship would in fact be stronger. Now that means that if this issue isn't addressed, then next year, a couple years later, I may ask them, they may go out to a 7, an 8, a 6, could actually de-escalate. But at the same time,
if this issue is addressed, there's a chance that the relationship would, in fact, be a lot stronger because they're seeing this is an area that needs to be worked on. Okay. Thank you both very much. So many things with communication and just more open dialogue and sharing can simplify our lives, can cause us to be happier, can create a sense of camaraderie, see connection, and greater association. One thing we want to do, is there one other party who's having trouble with someone else? Was willing to come up? Well, you don't even have to come up. But if you have, if there's someone who you're having an issue with, say the person is not even here. Okay? Is the person here or not here? Not here? Okay. Just to summarize for us what you see as a problem.
I've been trying very hard over the last 3 years to try and resolve this issue. Because I've been trying to see from the other person's point of view, and I still haven't been able to figure out why. Just trying to summarize the story short. In Melbourne, I did the service of painting Lord Jagannath. And it was about 2 days before Lord Jagannath was due to come back for Arthiasha. And not many devotees had sent cards or flowers or honey or anything to say, you know, we're missing you, hope you're feeling well. So, as a pujari, I always feel I should stick a bottle on the people and get motivated to do something. So I put a note on the temple room door that said, will Lord Jagannath return? But if not, please send flowers, cards, gifts like that. And my reasoning was is that you can't make Lord Jagannath come back just by fitting him in your schedule. You have to show him that you want him to come back, that you miss him. So, should I mention who it was?
No, you have to.
Okay. No. The person in question was offended that I put the note up. And actually, the next morning, somebody at Reading of the Vidhi said, oh, and Mother Bhakti has asked, could we please send, you know, flowers, honey, something. And the person in question said, Lord Jagannath is not up there. Lord Jagannath doesn't get sick, he's just up there because he needs to get painted. And a lot of the devotees were very confused. And I've never been able to figure out why that person said that.
Okay, now what I'd like you to do, even though you were not able to figure out whether that person said that, I would like you to put yourself as if you were that person right now, and put yourself as if you were that person, and you just give some seemingly rational argument or logic why you have done what you've done. You are that person, and you give some type of rational explanation of why you have said or done what you've said.
Well,
I mean, you don't have to yourself, you don't actually believe it or accept it, but you just share what are some possibilities of why that person could have done like that.
I could possibly figure out why the person had said it in the first place. From my experience of the person's reactions to situations, was that perhaps he was confronted that because he was an authority, that I had gone ahead and confuse people's minds as to would Lord Jagannath return or not, and maybe frighten some devotees that Lord Jagannath wasn't going to come back, and that he felt that as an authority, maybe it should have been him or another authority that had made a comment to the other devotees rather than me saying something.
Okay, now I want you to be that person, not to just think of what that person may have been thinking, but I want you to be that person.
How would I do that?
Holy. In other words, I want you to act like you are that person talking to you
with the way that person has given you something, said to you, I want you to be that person, explaining why you shouldn't have done what you did. I want you to try his best. Not to think why the person felt justified. I want you to try to be that person now. Talking to you, who is someone else now. I want you to be that person. And you explain why they shouldn't have done what they did. Just try.
If I could do that, I could probably hurt anything else.
I want you to try. Just give some argument, as if you were that person. You just gotta give some argument, as if you were that person telling someone who did what you did, why it was improper.
Could
it help you? Instead of be the person, I mean, just some logical argument. Not just sentiment, but just give some type of logical something of why you were saying this. Just try to be that person. He's disturbed about this. Just try to really be that person who is disturbed about what you've done. And he has, in his mind, some good reason why you did something that's improper. Just really try to be that person and then share, you know, share some statement.
The only thing that I could think of is that because the person is the authority.
Well, be that person. I am the authority.
I'm the authority.
Okay, and you're talking to yourself. You're talking to the other person. Just try to be that person talking now. Just assume for a minute, I'm the one who did this, who did what you did. You're the authority, and you're disturbed. Now you tell me something based on the fact that you honestly feel that what I did was not proper, wasn't the best thing. You just call me, you know, you're the temple president, whoever it was, you're the authority who's seen that note that I just wrote up there, and it's bothering you, and you have some rational reason, and now you explain.
You should have come to me. Maybe we could have done something to make the other devotees aware.
Okay, that's good. That's good. That's good. So, the reason I did that is because even though someone may have done something that we definitely don't agree with, but sometimes we fail to recognize that they had their own justification. Sometimes when we consider what their justification is, sometimes we're ready to accept and completely change our view. Sometimes not. But even if we're not ready to change our view, many times we can become more sensitive to why someone has given certain types of responses. Because our duty is not only to do what we do well, but to try to do whatever we can to encourage others. So even if we do something that causes somebody to make an offense, and we are right, we still have a duty to try to minimize causing anybody to make offense as well as ourselves making offense. So it becomes harder to minimize some incoherence if we're not often trying to see why how someone else is, you know, is actually thinking. Many times as devotees and as people in general, when we're having some incoherence with someone, we don't step into a space of trying to see why they feel differently or why they have done something. It doesn't mean we're going to have to agree, but at least gives us more perspective, more view, more facility to be able to be a servant, to be able to resolve something, or to be able to understand how to do something different so that we can do the right thing in the right way that doesn't cause a problem. Now she was having trouble because basically there is some either hurt or anger about the situation. So it was hard for her to really to think that he could even think rationally about what he did. And so her first expression was what we call, you know, was a role play. I am the authority. But then we questioned her a little deeper. She brought up the point, well, you know, you could have communicated with me and we could have, you know, presented this in a certain way. And so after she got a little beyond just seeing him only at fault, she was able to reflect a little bit that maybe there was some rational consideration as far as his thinking of why he did what he did. So there are times when we have to be careful not just to react with anger or feel hurt or victimized, even though that may be the case, that somebody has wronged us. But we want, at the end of the day, to do what we can so that we're Christian consciousness and we help someone else in their Christian consciousness. So what happened in the process is she walked away hurt. She became hurt from that. Perhaps the person who did such major events or felt threat, this authority felt threat, and the relationship is suffering, even to the point that she's having some problems, you know, up to now, concerning him. So to a certain extent, she's taken away from some of her devotion because that's given some anxiety. Even she thinks about it, she gets anxiety again. And so she allowed whatever the person did, let's consider that the person was 100% wrong. But she's allowing the person to keep on attacking her, assaulting her, day after day, as she's reflecting on this and not letting it go. She's allowing herself to see and think of this person, perhaps in a way that's not quite so devotional because of the pain and hurt. But how much better if that happened, and there's always going to be some conflict, but after it happened, if she would try to look a little closer to think, what on her part could she have done differently to allow what she had to say happen, but in a way that it wouldn't have caused the person to react, or this person to react, in the way that, you know, that he did. What could she have done that could have caused this person not to make an offense? Because by him making an offense, his own spiritual life, you know, in some ways has been hurt. So it goes beyond just seeing only as we are viewing, but trying to look again at how to communicate, how to serve, how to allow the situation to be a win-win for everyone. So let's just summarize. So we're talking about that there's three different types of conflicts, that in Kali Yuga especially, no question, it's unavoidable. And so we want to be more and more successful, so that means the more successful we are, the more we can expediently, judiciously be able to deal with conflicts. And not only do we want to be able to deal with them, but we want to be in the mode of what is Jananda, Pariyasakor, Shivasakor, Krishna, many examples in Prabhupada, is that we don't want to give in to Maya, nor do we want to just get caught up in having to be in the combative mood. But we want to do as Pariyas. He didn't give in to the prostitute, nor did he get into an attack, but he converted her. He used that situation to bring up more Krishna, not fall down, or not waste time or energy in a combative position, that still would have been a defeat to a certain extent. But how to convert a simply negative situation. We have the devotees here telling them closer at the fact that there are ways to improve in a relationship and always things have to be, you know, addressed. But so many times people even live in the same house and they don't talk about what's bothering them. Or they know issues that bother each other, but they still don't put the energy into trying to resolve. Or in the case of the temple commander James. So what James was accepting is that there are things that he could be doing a little better in a relationship. But for some reason, he hasn't found the energy, courage, determination, you know, to be able to do it. And so he's putting some stress on the temple commander, who then either has to do it himself, or has to wait for it to happen later, or to give it to someone else. And so in this way, we want to do whatever we have to do, but we also want to see that we're being served on the servant. Conflict of resources, he says the easiest one to resolve is usually just over material things. Conflict of psychological needs, having to deal more with security, with affection, with esteem. It has to do with certain mental and emotional things that are missing or that are somehow in some disarray. Conflict of values has to do with sense of morality, ethics, philosophy, philosophical views, religious affiliations, and connections. So we're saying that when we're trying to deal with conflict, one of the first things that come to mind is what is the type of issue. And so if we think it's a conflict of resources, and we're just trying to deal with the external, we won't resolve it because it may be more psychological or philosophical.
But we think if it's philosophical and it's really resources, it's not going to be resolved. If we think that people are arguing a rhythmic deposition because of philosophical concerns, but it actually has more to do, say, in the case, this is the hypothetical, if it has to do with property. And so they're pretending that it's philosophical or religious, but the real issue is property. So then to resolve this, it's not going to be just trying to deal with philosophical understanding and clarification, because what it's really about is resources. Or if it's about resources, and we're thinking it's having to do with other types of needs, it's not going to be resolved, because somebody, what they really want, they want money, they want property, they want a car, and once that is done, then it's different. So let's first look at what is the type of real issue underlying that is being addressed. Then we look again, from what type? Is it a conflict that's mainly going on within one's own being, something that's happening that one is having trouble with low self-esteem, they're having trouble with fear, anger? Is it more of an intrapersonal affair or is it interpersonal? Two people are having some fight, discussion problem. Is it really a problem between the two of them, or is it really mainly a problem that somebody, him or herself, is dysfunctional? You try to solve between the two of them, and it's really having to do more with some personal, dysfunctional thing, it won't be resolved because the issue is more interpersonal. Is it intra-community or inter-community? Inter-community means it's something between Vaishnavas themselves. Or is it our Vaishnava community in contrast to the Muslim community or the Christian community, etc.? So, certain ways to deal with it is an in-house affair. Another way to approach it, if it's one group, you know, versus another group. Sometimes it's all of these in one, other times it's particularly one, but it's important to resolve which one it in fact is, then to see how to address it. Then we're looking at is that we can see any of these things as a problem. Just like the discussion here between by Jagannath and asking for some things for Jagannath. Now, she could have taken this whole issue and considered why really is this person disturbed? And seem to consider that what's really going on is some insecurity. Perhaps what is really happening is this person is crying out, feeling that his authority is being trespassed on. This person is having some insecurity within himself. She goes through this whole problem and felt kind of more sorry for this person, that he had to react in such excessive way due to some insecurities about his authority. So he's really kind of crying out to be recognized, crying out to be considered first of all what is to be done, and feeling that something was happening independent outside of his jurisdiction. So one sense can see it instead of this thing as negative, can see it as someone who's having some issue within himself, a dysfunctional situation, and to try to see if possible if there's a way that person can be helped. If we see it as negative, then we can also get stressed out, become angry, become disturbed, we decide we don't want to work with that person, or whatever. And then at the end of the day, that serves to qualify, or at the end of the day, the apparatus has happened. Or now, the next time we see that person, the next issue happens, becomes even more accelerated because we're already carrying that wound. It's a good point. If the person is in the dominant role position and they're coming down harsh and hard like this, and if we somehow do not see that as negative, are we in fact feeding that person's ego, adding to the fire? Not necessarily. We are feeding it if we are in avoidance, if there's nothing happening. And then the person thinks that they're okay. We're also adding to it if we attack, because then the person is going to attack back. So what's important here is somehow if the person can understand that we live in meaning on, so that at least there's some line of communication, and then we have a chance to express what has happened based on our perspective, with the hope that the person will be able to process it. It's definitely a cry out for dominance, for control, etc. Now, if someone is really feeling that kind of insecurity, like sometimes if somebody's crazy, let's say really mentally ill. So sometimes, in order to help this person, you have to do certain things that creates a dialogue or some flow of communication. Not that you are going to reinforce that, but that you have to connect. Once the connection is there, then there is possibly chance that you can be able to help that person. Somebody who's so insecure, if they not see you as a friend or as a well-wisher, then there's no way you're going to really be able to help them so much. But if somehow they can see you as a well-wisher, then there is a greater opportunity to be helping to see that I care about you, I appreciate what you are doing, but you could be doing a lot better by like this. Then there's a bigger chance that they can hear how to improve. But if they're just hearing that you are discouraged with them, you're mad with them, you feel they're doing wrong, then the tendency is to just defend. Or they ignore, or they categorize you. It's easier to change when somebody is trying to instruct you or give you some advice who you feel is actually in your corner. Still the ego will jump in, but it's a little easier. But when you feel that the person doesn't really have your well-being is a major concern, or you feel that the person is trying to demise you, to put you down, then the tendency is you just categorize whatever they say as just coming from that field, and then one doesn't have a chance to take advantage. And even if the person doesn't change, say to take the worst case, even if the person doesn't change, it's our duty to not let that person bring us down. By having anger, by getting combative moods, by holding a grudge, we have allowed that person to take away some of our own spiritual progress. So if we can't help, we surely don't want to hurt ourselves. Things that accelerate conflict. So we looked at how often something happens, but what are the things that amplifies it and makes it get worse? Poor communications, aggression, revenge, frustrated love, lack of trust. We went through some of these. You can see how just one of these problems that we had, that if it's not addressed in time, it can in fact accelerate something worse. It can lead into different kinds of speculation, say in the case of with the authority of that person. Then this person can start saying this happened and she did this and he said when this happened. Then somebody speculates and then it accelerates and then they start having coalitions, getting people to accept what they're thinking, others are getting to accept, and then it gets to a point that they're not ready to serve together. Then it gets to a point they write to GBC, they write to Guru, and someone is thinking that it's trying to get them out of their position, and it can just go on and on, and everybody suffers from it. Both parties suffer. When it didn't have to anyway, goes into that extent. We said that I went only by your destruction is the way that demons pursue their relationships. Demons' concern is how to finish someone off. They're considering they can only exist and prevail by the demise, the destruction of others. Whenever they have this kind of mindset in dealing with somebody else, this is the way that the Vajrachakra think. Even if somebody is wrong, we're feeling that we have to destroy that person. We have to see that person completely finished. This is not compassion. This is not mercy. This is not forgiveness. And it surely is not thinking about the highest well-being of that person. You win only by my destruction. The other way is that I win only by destroying you, or you win only by destroying me. Both of this is in the demonic category. One party is feeling that they have to finish the other one off, the other party is going to have to finish it.
This is the main consideration, how to destroy. The other one is that only one of us can win. But somebody's got to lose. Either you're going to lose or have to lose. But it's definitely a paradigm that somebody is going to lose and is not going to be me. You're thinking the same. Not quite as easy, but because it's not that I can win only if I can destroy you. I can win if I defeat you, but not that I have to destroy you. I have to get what I want, and yeah, not that you have to be finished. And in both cases, lose-lose. And sometimes in Kali Yuga, people are so gross, they don't care if they lose, they just want to make sure the other person, you know, suffers. They're ready to suffer, they just want to make sure the other person suffers. I may suffer by this, but I'm so angry, I just want to make sure that this person suffers. And of course, we're talking about what is spiritual, is that somehow through the exchange that both parties come out with greater realization, greater attention to be able to serve Guru and Krishna, greater appreciation for their weaknesses and their strengths, and somebody else's strengths and weaknesses. And when they see somebody who's weak, they are more ready to try to see how to help that person. When you're on a team, somebody's weak, you don't just try to destroy them or try to ignore them. You're dealing with the fact that this person is weak and is going to weaken our effort. So you want to do something because that person is a part of your family. It's a team player. Even if they're wrong, you want to somehow compliment them. You want to be able to assist them so that they can be able to make a change. Or you want to see what you need to change in you to be able to change the other person. Five particular ways of things not to do. We actually think about conflicts that you were not able to resolve, and you will find that these factors are going on. So we get five approaches to things not to do, and eight approaches to ways of what can be done. And so the first one is that genuine issue is there, but you just get into a combative mode. That this is another form of maya, either to get somebody interested in, or to destroy them, or to get them so occupied in a combative state that there's no time to preach, to work on your sadhana, no time to do the things that we're really about. The other way is avoidance. To ignore it as if nothing has happened, it's just going to go away, and then it will service in some other sense. We have so many problems in our movement. But we've used this particular approach. And also this one will come to this. Where the issues that we could resolve very easily, we get into a, you know, heavy fighting mood without trying to understand the other person's point of view. We can understand the other person's point of view, still disagree. But by understanding why someone has done what they have done, then we can have more empathy in trying to see how it brings a sense of wholeness. We just take, for instance, we take people who went to Narayana Maharaj, people who went to Sri Maharaj, people who, you know, became Rithviks, people who then go against us and lost and whatnot. We take this kind of combative mood. It can be very intense and go on for years and years and years. Sometimes at that level already, and it's, you know, beyond the immediate chance, you know, to be able to resolve. But if we immediately, at first look at someone who's an adversary and try to consider, oh, okay, this person is Rithvik, let's look at the situation. They had two gurus who fallen down. They were temple presidents, one of them times. They got kind of heavied out by another temple president, original secretary by GBC. And so we look and think, okay, so their philosophy is off, but there are certain things in their mind that has justified why they have accepted or certain type of position. And then we have a little more resources to try to understand how to bring some type of resolution, rather than just immediately, you know, going to war. Role play is what she was considering that the authority was doing. That I'm the authority, and so just accept the fact that what I feel should be done, the relationship, you know, to Jagannath. So oftentimes people do have this kind of, you know, mindset. And this is the way they justify things. But we tried to help Kapha go a little deeper. Maybe this is where he was coming from. But perhaps in his mind is that this act was another sign of some of the people in the community or some of the devotees who are undermining his particular authority, and he got a security issue. And so what was really happening is that it wasn't something that he himself initiated, and so therefore it became an accelerated problem. Vanity is that often genuine issue is there, and we just try to do something very secondary, superficially, because it's a crisis, and we just go from one crisis to the next. So the idea is just to do something and then move on. But then if we don't address it deeply, it's going to be like a cancer, and it'll come back and it'll haunt us. Bargaining is when it's normally okay, but because we're talking about a spiritual situation, we don't want to just create compromise, where people compromise just to, you know, end something, but still they walk away with some anxieties, some lack of happiness, and then later they position themselves to try to get more of what they expected that they should get. But the idea is that there is distinct conflict, and we look at the conflict as not just something negative, but we can try to see the conflict as a chance to look closer at needs, a chance to look closer at aspirations, a chance to look closer at systems to see if they're working or not working, what the effects are, a chance to be able to see and reflect on how we can serve. So as soon as there's a conflict, we should immediately try to allow ourselves not to just first think of it as something bad, but to think there is some need here. Let's try to see, what is the need? What is the point of ambiguity that we can clarify? What is the issue where we need to explain a little better why we've done what we've done? What is the point that we need to see what is happening with the other person? So if we can see it as a chance to know that there's opportunity to render service. Now we look to see what is the kind of service that it is called for. Instead of negative, we see it that there's some issue that is a love factor that's missing, a family factor, if we're having these things amongst Vaishnavas so much, that needs to be addressed. Now the last point here was 8 steps for bringing resolution. Those 5 things not to do, and these are some of the things that can work, that can minimize, and in many cases can totally eradicate, you know, the particular conflict. Create effective atmosphere. Sometimes the environment itself is very important, that if we are in a conflictual environment, it itself is going to not allow eradication or clarification. In the process of, after we have got the neutral environment, where parties are in the position, hopefully, to be able to try to be fully present, then there's a need for clarifying perceptions. Sometimes just this alone takes away the conflict. When people have a chance to really to see what the other person's idea, consideration about what's going on, and we find that the reality is totally different as we compare and look at the perceptions. And or we see that a person is perceiving things in such a way that it causes them to act based on their perception. Someone has a perception that you really want them out of this country. And so you come and you discuss, and they find that it wasn't that you really wanted them out, you just had a particular problem with one or two areas of stuff that they're doing. Because they think that you want them out of ISKCON, but anything you do, anything you say, they put it in the category that you're their enemy, because really you just want them out. And they can't hear from you, they can't communicate with you, they can't respect what you do because of the perception that they have of you. Focus on individual and shared needs. So many times, we have so much that we share and agree on. And the areas that we disagree are minute. But we allow those areas that are minute to encompass our whole consciousness and begins to dictate our whole relationships. And it causes us even to forget what has happened and what we share. The last thing I was trying to do was trying to get two people who were having a conflict that's going on now, and they're present. One thing that I was going to do in that exchange, have them sit in a studio together, share what they see as their problem, and especially if they both had these differences. James agreed. He felt that he was, that he could improve. But sometimes each person is feeling that the other one is wrong. And they're strong about it. And so sometimes these persons have shared so many, many things, together. As friends, as devotees associated, husband and wife, as mother and father, as a sister and brother, etc. And so they have allowed one or two things now to encompass their whole relationship. And now it's because they're not talking to each other, or they're holding grudges, or whatever. So sometimes we walk a person through first to see how many things that they do share together. How many ways they have actually benefited each other in the past. How much they really do care about each other once you remove those two obstacles or whatever. And sometimes you can help them just by then asking them, what if you knew that this God brother who you're having trouble with is going to die in 2 weeks? What would you want to say to that person? What would you want to do that you're not saying or doing now? What would the problem that you are now seeing as so important, to what degree would it really be important? What would you lose if now that person is no longer existing? And many times we have been able to see that there's so many things that we do have in common, so many things that we do share, so many things that we do need from that person, and how much we've allowed some issues to cloud the whole relationship. And if that person is no longer with us, how much we would be at a loss and what we would lose. And the thing that we would lose, the thing that we're losing now, because we've allowed this barrier to not be able to have healthy communications or be able to benefit from what each other can bring into the environment and into the association. And that happens. I mean, the mind is so crazy. The mind can just dwell on something and it just creates anger and frustration. And all you know is just see that when you look at the person. And especially when it comes to Vaishnavas, even somebody who's obnoxious in so many ways, who has so many wonderful qualities that we often can minimize if we don't try to see it from a win-win, from a spiritual perspective, look to the future and learn from the past. Many times, whatever the problem is, won't go anywhere to be able to resolve it if we are just thinking about what happened in the past. So many times people are arguing and have a problem, and they're just reflecting on the past, or each one has their own idea where the other person made a mistake, and they keep wanting to bring it up. But what about if you did this that time, and you did this? Well, yes, the past did happen. But we cannot move on and have a wholeness if parties are still trying to work out things in the past like it's still the present. The idea is at some point realizing that we want to learn from the past. It happened and it was some kind of reality perceived or a categorical, but we want to learn from that while we are looking toward the future. You say, you were more involved in the past. More fault, you started, okay, you put all of that to the side, and that's the past. Now the point is, what do we do for the present? Most important, what do we do for the future? When parties are often ready to put the past behind, whole shift begins to take place, because now they're not living from the past and being clouded by what happened and different shades of what took place. Generate options. Free flow, develop goals, create stepping stones of action. In other words, one begins, say you're trying to facilitate some arguments going on, and so then you try to start sharing some possibilities that both parties could consider accepting, until you come to a point that you have something that all parties are comfortable with. And once you have that, by getting them now not going to the past, by seeing, letting them see how much they have that is shared, how much they need each other, how much they really do care about each other, how much has happened in the past that has been good, clarifying now the perceptions of what has gone wrong,
And now, after you get some things that parties are ready to agree on, then you bring closure by making some mutual benefit agreement, getting some things distinct that the parties now both agree that they're going to maintain, so that it doesn't just get lost again some weeks later, the same problem comes up. Some areas that they distinctly now are ready to work on, so that the relationship is binding and is more devotional and less or totally void of the stress. We just have to remind ourselves, when we are in conflict with somebody, we suffer. When we are in anxiety of a situation, it takes away from our spiritual acceleration. Whether we are right or wrong, or whether they're right or wrong, that everybody suffers. And sometimes it's avarads that can go on and on. And one of the greatest problems in our society is Vaishnava avarad. From devotees on a day-to-day basis, or leaders on down, is that avarads are so serious that as we have avarads, our spiritual immune system gets weak and we fall prey to all kinds of mind. It's so important in our society that we find ways to minimize the avarads, that we find ways to minimize overreacting or underreacting. So our legal case here with the land, legal cases we have all over the world now. And a lot of these have to do with a combative type of mentality or an avoidance. Avoidance, and then if we act like nothing's going on, it gets worse. Or we come into a situation of combativeness. And then what happens is that even if we win, who really wins? The lawyers. And even if we do win, we've made avarads, or we get the person to make more avarads. And so what is winning in the process? So many people then go off into maya. So it's so important in our own communities as well as in the secular world. We're about to see nuclear chemical warfare and so many things, because everywhere people are so much in a combative type of mentality, and they're only seeing their vision, their ideas, and they're ready to carry it out without considering what it means on other people. It's like now, lessening. So look at, you know, the cowboy in America, Bush. So now he's making these plans, but there's a part of him, a major part of him, is not thinking that when there's war, that means so many people are going to lose their mothers and fathers, I mean children. So many people who also are wanting health, protection, security are going to die. So much disease from the fallout. So much reaction, so much fear. But the tendency is, one is thinking about their sovereign interests and not being so much concerned, ultimately, about what it means in other areas. And so even if there is strong winning in this area, the amount of anger, pain, and suffering that people undergo is tremendous. And this taking over a situation with a lot of people who are angry and wounded and distraught is not a win-win. It's surely not spiritual. So devotees want to constantly try to see how to raise everything to, you know, to a higher nature. And that means even when someone's wrong, we want to try to understand them a little better so we can somehow try to help or to change them, other than adding to the problem or letting them create the problem for ourselves. So we'll stop there. Any questions or comments? Please. Please. Yeah. You want to hand this to us, because in the back they may not be able to hear.
Because we naturally look up to devotees, that they have so many good qualities. But then when you get in nature, there is so much about them that you don't like. So it's that love-hate type relationship. So I'm thinking, when
Well, they can be different. Usually, you know, they're pretty much associated with each other. They're, you know, like cousins. But often, this enviousness has its natural way of manifesting also jealousy. Because enviousness is someone is feeling that they are more deserving. They're feeling, again, what is going somewhere else should be going to them. They're having also sometimes some sense of lack of self-esteem. It's coming out, you know, in a perverted way, feeling that they should be appreciated better, appreciated more. So, yeah, they're like cousins. In a sense, they kind of go together. Well, you can.
I'm thinking that, you know, the only thing is the material nature, and it's related to material nature, but actually it's to do with the Lord.
Yes.
And so I'm a bit confused, and I don't even know.
No. You're actually sort of answering your own question. When we find ourselves envious of someone else, that's part of the indicator of our enviousness of Krishna. Because as we are envious of someone else's achievement, success, opulence, or whatever, it's part of the original disease of being envious of Krishna. When we see someone having something, excelling, and we can really appreciate them and be happy for them, then we're becoming less envious of Krishna. So as we are finding ourselves envious of someone else, that should be like a wake-up call. Oh, this is part of why I'm in the material world, because this is radiating some of my enviousness that I have toward the Lord. That I'm not in direct contact with the Lord, and so it is manifesting in so many ways to other people who are achieving, who are excelling, who have something that I would like to have, etc. And as we find that we have less disturbance with people in terms of being jealous and envious, we can realize we have less enviousness of Krishna. Mm-hmm.
I find myself quite often feeling sorry for people, like that they're missing out, that they're not, you know, coming to the temple or things like that. And then I get told by other devotees I'm being critical because I'm thinking I'm better than they are. But I don't feel like I am, but maybe I am, I don't know. But I actually sincerely feel that, you know, I want them to have that place that I have, but other people think I'm being critical.
Well, that's a matter of individual consciousness. We can call somebody out on the problem that they're having because we genuinely are concerned about them, and sometimes we can do the same action, but we're really trying to show, that we're better. And so the action doesn't always let us know what the consciousness is. We can call someone out as a way of showing that we don't do that. I'm so much better. And so I'm going to, Prabhu, I want to help you. You are really in Maya, and I am a very good devotee, and I'm going to help you. If we approach it in that way, then of course, you know, is not so genuine. But we're approaching it in the mood, we really care that this person is hurting their own spiritual life. And we want, if possible, somehow to help them to be able to take more advantage of the process. So that's more of a genuine concern about their well-being. But there are, you know, devotees who are rather, you know, strong and strict in some ways, but it's sort of artificial. But when they try to help somebody, they really let the person know that they are in a superior position. and that this person is needy and is fallen, and that they are really going to show their mercy by really helping this person. And so that kind of ego later will cause that person to have problems also. Yes.
Maharaj, you were mentioning often the competitive mood in our society. And I have a question regarding that, because especially in the beginning, say the 1980s, it was more prevalent than now.
Mm-hmm.
So sometimes I think, for example, if you look at Bhaktisiddhanta Maharaj, he was known as the lion ruler, and everyone knows he used the chopping technique to defeat his opponents.
Mm-hmm.
And Srila Prabhupada, somehow he also took that move, and you know that Srila Prabhupada was very heavy on philosophical points. Mm-hmm. And always sometimes sent his disciples to defeat an opponent. And after Srila Prabhupada left, the devotees took over that mood and went to oppose parties or individuals and defeat them. So sometimes I think that how can we understand? Because devotees sometimes say, yes, I have to act like this because Prabhupada did like this, and we have to take all Prabhupada's mood, and I will show them that we are not Hindus, we are Krishna conscious, whatever, you know,
mm-hmm.
things like this. So can you maybe comment on this?
Yeah, a couple of things. There are statements where Prabhupada has said, what is the value if people walk away angry? That in our preaching, if people walk away angry, even though we've said what is necessary or proper in terms of what is philosophically sound, but they walk away angry, you know, what is the value? Also, we see that our entire mission is Lord Caitanya in disguise, Krishna in disguise, so that he can give the most benefit to the largest number of people. Krishna is coming in the Bhava, Srimata Radharani, Lord Caitanya. He takes, you know, the sannyas, just so people will not make offense, and he can be able to help them more. He is going to every town, every village, organizing his devotees who are also in disguise, and that they are eternal servants of the spiritual world, and they are strategizing, trying to see how best how to help people. We're giving our prasadam, the holy name, helping people who are consciously and unconsciously. So it's not just a matter of just forcing our philosophy on people. So the same Prabhupada who sometimes was like a lion in that sense, also, in many cases, just charmed people and didn't even preach at all and won, you know, many, many people over. Let's see. I mean, and as an example, Prabhupada was on a walk and this lady was coming by in the morning sometimes, and he would say, how are you? And so it was in L.A. and one of the devotees were asking, Prabhupada, why you don't say Hare Krishna? And he explained that she will respond and think better of us by like this. This is according to the time, place, and the situation. We explain also how when Prabhupada was living with George Harrison, he never preached to, you know, to the gardener once, but he was just kind to him. And up until that man died, he was so, you know, favorable because of how Prabhupada gave kindness. There were some parents, some people came in and Prabhupada smashed them. You know, this cardinal, that person. You know, why are you eating meat? In other cases, he just charmed them. Now, but we should know that when the pure devotee of Krishna smashes somebody, that they're getting really, really special mercy. So if we're that pure, we can smash everybody anytime. It's okay. But, you know, our position is to communicate and to help. And the more we can do that, then, you know, the more the mission goes. Therefore, we have to be careful as devotees to not to be condescending toward others. We have to be careful that when we're preaching to people and we're trying to help them, that we also are understanding and appreciating where they are and what they have. See, so many devotees who preach to people in other groups and other environments, and they really don't respect the people. And it gets transmitted. in the preaching. Because somebody's preaching to you, you've been doing some hatha yoga, some kriya yoga for 25 years, and they're telling you that your whole existence up to that time is maya. So how receptive are you going to be when somebody's telling you everything you've done up to that time is maya? But somebody tell you that, oh, how wonderful it is that you have been engaged in some level of austerity. How wonderful it is that you are following a certain degree of dharma. How wonderful it is that you are definitely crying out for God in your own way, but you're crying out. And how wonderful it is that we have something that can help you to be able to accelerate and do that with even more profundity. So when many times when people hear that we can help them to go deeper in whatever they're starting, they can become more eager. But if we are telling them that they have to put away whatever they have and take what we have, then we're going to keep having what we have now. We have a movement, but right now there are so many things happening in the world, and in most countries, in most places, we're not even very relevant. We should be the people when there's issues about ecology, issues about war, issues about education, issues about relationship, issues about ecological change, whatever, that our voice, you know, should be there. And our consideration and view, it should be there. But most people, most places, people see us, you know, nice, Hare Krishna people doing something, and but that we're not so relevant. In most places, it's like that. And it should be that way. Because we have transcendental knowledge to be able to bring forth to any and everything. Whether it's, you know, it's gardening, it's farming, whether it's parenting, whether it's education, dealing with drugs, with alcohol, all these things. Our philosophy gives some guidance about what can be done to be a better person. But why do we have so many people all over the world who are in the mode of goodness, who hate us? It's one thing for people to dislike us, who are demons. But for people who are theists and are taking to a life of some austerity, the vegetarians, the meditators, the what? And if we just think, oh, they're just impersonalists and they're useless, we're going to keep missing thousands, and in some cases millions of people who we could be trying to help and show them that we have something higher. But if we somehow are able to package or able to live our philosophy more, see, if you analyze it, majority of people who don't like us, they don't like us because of things that we do that are not Krishna conscious. Majority of things that people have issues with us on is weaknesses that we bring into the Krishna conscious movement. Our own stuff, you know, different types of deviations that really have nothing to do with who we, you know, genuinely are. Or people don't like us because when they invite us to interfaith gatherings, or they invite us to conscious raising things, and in most cases they just see that we don't care about nothing, about what's really going on, other than what we have to say. And people see that and they hear that. And then they decide, okay, don't invite the Hare Krishnas anymore. Let's see. So it's unfortunate. I mean, we want to be chaste what we are. People should see us as being very exceptional in our vows and our commitments, but not that we come across so arrogant that even those who we could have different types of alliances with don't really want to come close to us. And we have to be honest, and we have to look and we have to think that there are so many things going on that's now this alternative that's about trying to make the world a better place. And in most cases, you know, we're not even included. You know, people do not see us as relevant. They just feel that we're too much caught up in our own thing. We have to look and we have to think, why is most of our marriages in divorce? Why is most of our children not happy about or accepting the process? Then we look at all that, we realize, well, it surely doesn't have anything wrong with the philosophy. It's not anything wrong with our acharyas, what Prabhupada has given us, Bodhisattva, etc. But what is something, the problem is our own roughness, insensitivity, fighting. you know, our in-house conflicts is awesome. You look at the number of conflict that we have amongst ourselves, and we see that, you know, we're our greatest enemy in that sense. Yes.
Maharaj, thank you very much for your delivery. It's very scientific. It's been pretty well reached most people in a lot of places. With regard to the application of conflict resolution, there are some difficulties. First of all, in the sense that, or particularly in this country, devotees find it very hard to be self-expressive or open their hearts toward the devotees, particularly Australians more so than any other nations. They sort of keep things bottled close to their chest, and probably the conditioning has also been in the past that if we have some problems which is resolved by chanting Hare Krishna.
Or fighting. Why don't you about the other?
So, like the application of conflict resolution can become, there can be some difficulties there. It can become like a double-edged sword where, like you mentioned on your first night, that you have two chairs there and, or you have one chair there and all of a sudden two students are fighting out one chair and you think that the problem is that there's not two chairs there. It's not the chair. So, particularly with opposite sexes, you always seem to, husband and wife or the person, whatever, you seem to fish up something, and something comes up as a tangent, and you may go off on that tangent. So,
that's where. Your point is strong. That's where it's a process. Just like the kind of discussions that we were having, even these short things, you know, this evening, it was actually hard for most people to do it. Because we're not these bodies, we're not these cultures, but we all are products, you know, of heredity and socialization. And so in the country, there is sort of a mood of not being, you know, so revealing. And so many people have things they could have shared, but, you know, there's some timidness in that sense. It also has to do with some of the ways that we're trained. Sometimes we're not having so much as to-go seats. We're not really being able to put things on the table unless we put it on the table, you know, with anxiety. We're afraid to say what we really feel because we feel the other person may become our enemy. We see and we don't see. And therefore, it becomes, pseudo communities. Because in real community, that you know, we all want to have more and more genuine communication and cooperation. And we want to really do, you know, to be there for each other. So it's a problem that we all have. We all have in Kali Yuga. In some places, a little more. Some places, the general mood of how we're brought up is that we want to look good. And so the tendency is, you know, not to be so revealing. In other places, there's a little more emphasis on, people sharing and revealing in that sense. It's just like, for example, I did the same assignment I did a little while ago in Croatia and in Russia. I would have had, three-quarters of the people's hands up. If I did the same thing in Switzerland, I would have been lucky if I would have got, one person. Sometimes, the mood's a little different, according to our training and whatnot. But as devotees, we want to rise above any of our, material cultures. We really want to maximize trying to get benefit from our associations with each other. And there's just so much that we can learn. I mean, you'll be surprised how often, people are married and they really don't really talk to each other about, deeper issues that's going on. They just kind of tolerate it going, and to suffer together. And where there's things that they really need to, need to address. Or when they do address, then it's only set a point, that it's an argument, or it's a fight, to that extent. But we just have to have more faith in Krishna. We have more faith in Krishna than we have more faith in each other. We have more faith that if we do the right thing, Krishna is going to come forth. Even if somebody is, trying to sabotage you, or defame you, Because we have more faith in Krishna. We have more faith that if we do the right thing, then Krishna has promised that he'll reciprocate and something auspicious, you know, will in fact happen to us. And so there is a need for us to really just somehow to create a greater support system where we can honestly be in a position where that if I'm having some weakness, I can reach out, I can speak out and say, you know, look, Prabhu, you know, I'm in trouble. I need some help, I need some advice. We see too often, even amongst our leaders, you know, we just had several leaders who've left, you know. And the initial was that they didn't have one person who they felt, you know, they could reveal their mind to, you know. And that's sad when we have so many devotees and somebody is having a problem and not one person they can reveal their mind to, and then they go. You know, this was the problem with Kripamokya, with, you know, with Jagadish and a few others. And one person who they really felt they could reveal and try to get some help, try to share something. And then it gets to a point, but then, you know, then they just leave. So why in a society that's supposed to be so much about serving each other and love and trust, and we have so much of this happening? And so this makes the reason I do some of these kind of courses also, because, you know, we see this, you know, as a plague that we need to address it a little closer. Otherwise, who is the next person that then decides that Krishna consciousness is not for them, or the next person commits suicide, or, you know, is on medication? We have hundreds of devotees who are on medication because of, you know, mental problems that's coming from anxieties within the society. And we have many devotees every year who are committing suicide. We don't hear about them because they're usually devotees who are now on the fringe. We call them on the fringe. And these are devotees who feel as if they are spiritual failures and material failures. And the anxiety and the pressure is just so intense. And unless we are able to have somehow closer community relationships, we're going to have more people who want to be in that sort of space. Krishna consciousness is very powerful, but it also can destroy your mature life. And so it's like, once you enter this process, the only way out of it is to advance. Iskand Pandit Dada Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Sri Prabhupada Ki.